The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Good morning. You are very welcome along to The Home Show with me, Sinead Ryan. This is News Talk Radio. Coming up today, top author Sinead Moriarty will be telling me about her creative space in our second episode of The Writer's Room. What can we learn from the public housing schemes of Ireland's past when we built a lot of houses? We're going to find out about the Irish Room in London's Museum of the Home. And sexing up your guest Lou, Denise O'Connor will be telling us how you can wow your friends. If you'd like to get involved in our show today, you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over on Instagram at SineadRyan100 and on X. Now, yes, a slight change in the weather there. September for me is all about a house project. Summer's over and the light, I suppose, a little bit lower and disappearing a little bit earlier in the day. So I always like to take the opportunity to do a little change up to my house budget allowing. I recently gave a spare room, which had been left boring and dull, kind of a bit of a remodel for very little money and a bit of elbow grease. And I got back a sunny sea blue guest room. And last year it was my downstairs loo. And it went from boring white to a Middle Eastern kind of vibe, which is a bit strange, but I quite like it and it looks quite nice. No expense, just paint, decals and a bit of lighting. So many people take the smallest room in the house to experiment with because it can be a bit of fun and you don't need it for everyday use. So stay tuned later on. Designer Denise O'Connor, this is her thing. She's written about it extensively. And later in the show, she will have the last word in rocking out a new loo on a budget. If you're feeling inspired, we have that and so much more. And you're very welcome along to The Home Show. Now, we got so much feedback on our new Writer's Room series, where we explore with top authors the space they write in, that we're continuing it this week. And my guest is top author Sinead Moriarty. You're very welcome to The Home Show studio.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Now, I always start by asking, tell us about, you know, where you live and what you love about it.
So I'm very lucky. Just before COVID, we moved to Monkstown, which is by the sea in Dublin. And I think it saved my sanity because I was able to go for within 2 kilometre radius was up and down the pier. And then the other thing, which is kind of astonishing, is that I am the least likely person in the entire world to swim in the freezing cold Irish Sea, but I've now become a sea.
I'm not even a
sea swimmer, I'm a sea bobber. I just get in, I bob up and down, and then I get out sharpish. But I was a bit reluctant to try it because I was worried because I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an inflammatory condition. And I kind of thought, God, you know, will it make it worse or better? And then I met someone who has the same condition, and they said, no, it's actually really good for inflammation. So I thought, okay, for many reasons, I'll do it. Also, apparently, the natural high, etc. So so I have a dry robe. I'm a total cliche, and I have the little booties for winter. But you know what? I do love it. I only get to do about maybe once a week, but it's brilliant. And it's more the crack after and the cup of tea from the flask, and you meet lovely people. And
yeah,
it's brilliant. And I kind of feel because I live by the sea, I had to embrace it almost. But it's been a really really beneficial. I love it.
So if you only moved then to a new house before COVID, that means you had to design a new writing space and a room where you write.
Yes.
So just describe it to us.
Like Virginia Woolf's, a room of my own. My room is not very glamorous. When we were doing up the house, we ended up having to do a lot of work. The builder was like, this room is just a cupboard, really. I mean, it's too small for an office. And I was there, no, it's actually perfect. I quite like having a small space. I kind of feel, I feel very snug and cozy in there. So there's just enough room for a desk. And like, I have a bookshelf behind me and shelves in front of me. And it's just crammed with books. There's books everywhere. And it's kind of organized chaos. And it's my chaos. And I have a cork board. And I have lots of different sort of, you know, pictures of my kids. And then I've got a gorgeous letter that may have been she wrote me when I was quite a new writer. I'd said something about her in an interview, something complimentary, and she wrote me this beautiful letter. She was such a class act. And just kind of bits and pieces that I find inspiring. So, it's small, it is. I mean, if I put my arms out really wide, I can almost touch both walls. But it's just my little space, it's my haven. So.
And is there something maybe that you find cocooning about that effect? Because some people might take out all the books and out the cork board and just have this open space.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I love being surrounded by books. I think I grew up in a house falling down with books, and that's what I feel comfortable with. And in the bookshelf behind me are all my favourite books that I've read and loved. And I think I just, you know, sometimes I just turn around and look at them. And yeah, it's just, it just works for me. I mean, cocooning is actually is a really good word. That's kind of what it is. I go in, that's my little space, and nobody can come in because they can't even fit in, really. So the kids just sort of stand at the door and ask questions. So it's actually quite nice. I just have my big chair, and that's where I sort of disappear into my writing world.
So in that small space then, with all these bookshelves, you mentioned there your diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis. Does that affect the type of furniture that you've chosen for the room, especially, I suppose, your chair?
Not really. I mean, I have a kind of a back support thing on the chair, but I am looking at getting a standing up desk, one that you can put up and down, because of a couple of, not because of rheumatoid, just in general, because I think I spend too much time sitting anyway, which isn't great for you. And I have a couple of writer pals who got them, and they said they're great. So they kind of write creatively sitting down, but then all the kind of editing or admin they do standing up. And I actually think that could work well. So I'm thinking about testing that out.
All right. Okay. And I've heard now there's new ones out that you can get, like that have a treadmill. So you're doing all that while walking.
That's too much going on there.
too much going on. Okay. What is your day like, Sinead? Because I know successful authors do not wait until the muse takes them and, you know, they kind of are inspired in the middle of the night with an idea. It's much more of a discipline.
Mm. Yeah. I think, look, anybody who is successful works hard, and there's no two ways about it. I don't find it hard to be disciplined because there's nothing else I want to do. I'm not that fussy about my house. It's quite messy. I will happily just leave stuff all over the place and just walk into my office and close the door. I don't think I could do what I do at home if I was, you know, a very tidy, neat person. Other writer pals can't write at home. They just find it just too much distraction. So they go out, maybe to the library or the coffee shop. But for me, I love being at home. I love when, you know, my kids are back in school or college or whatever, the house is really quiet. So September is actually my favourite month because I get my little routine back, I get my quiet house back. And yeah, so there's always something to do in the house. You could be distracted every 5 seconds, but I literally just, I put my phone on silent, I go up to my office, and that's kind of it, really.
Mm. And in terms then of what you need to get into that head on to write, some people like music on in the background, some people like total silence, the lighting can be important. Tell me about your space.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I certainly couldn't write to music. I find it too distracting. I like quiet. I like just like complete quiet, just to allow my brain, I suppose, to think. And also, my head is quite noisy with characters and plots, so I don't want any external noise. I know Stephen King writes to heavy metal. I don't know how he does it. But I mean, to each their own. It works for him. But yeah, no, for me, I need complete silence because there's a lot going on in my own head. So I don't want to be distracted by anything else.
Mm.
Now, look, there are some days I go in and I end up sort of shopping online for an hour. Like, I'm not saying I'm this amazingly disciplined person who goes in and writes for 6-7 hours solid. You know, I do get distracted. But I love routine. It really works for me.
Mm. And is there anywhere else you write? I mean, you know, I suppose there, with the travel you do and the publicity you do and places you have to go, you know, there's deadlines and you have to get stuff done. So are you able to write on a bus, a plane, a train, or no?
Yeah, it's funny, actually. A lot of people do write on the hoof. No, I don't really. But what I do is, I sort of, it's my treat to myself every year. Usually coming up to a deadline, I will book 4 days in the artist retreat, the Tyrone Guthrie artist retreat in Monaghan, and Tyrone Guthrie bequeathed his estate to the government with the kind of caveat that it was to be an artist retreat. So when you go down, there are sculptors and artists and musicians, and there was a street kind of gymnastics people there one time, and then there are playwrights and actors, and the only thing you do is you have to have dinner together at 7 o'clock every night, and the rest of the time you're in your room, or for the artists they have a studio. And you do your own thing, and then together you come together at 7 o'clock every night, and it's brilliant because you meet the most interesting people. And then the food is incredible, which I love. And I don't have to do anything; I just literally have the entire day and night to write, and it's kind of magic. So yeah. I treat myself to that every year.
Ah, oh, very good. Mm. Okay, well, look, you're on your book number. Is it 2019?
So that is, this is my 20th book.
20th book. Mm. All right. Well, talk to me about this book. It's a children's book called "Fixing Mum and Dad." Mm. Do you need a different headspace? You write a lot about home, homelessness, which has been a feature.
Yeah.
Sisters, of course, keep making a reappearance. Yeah. So I'm getting the sense that that's a really important theme for you.
Yeah, I mean, I've written 17 adult novels, and they've always been about family. And, you know, I think the crux of life is family, whether you get on with your family or don't get on with your family, whether you've chosen them or not chosen them. They make you who you are and they affect your life. So after many years of writing for adults, I decided I also wanted to add a children's book to my kind of workload. And I'd always wanted to write for children. My children had always begged me to write for children, but I couldn't figure out what I wanted to say. And then when the Syrian crisis was at its kind of height, maybe 6-7 years ago, there was that awful picture of the little boy being washed up on the beach.
Yes.
And I just went, you know, my kids were kind of going, like, why would you get in a boat if you can't swim? And I just went, they're not getting it. So I just felt kind of compelled, actually, to write a book about a little Syrian refugee who comes to Ireland. I met this amazing Syrian family through a Refugee Association of Ireland, and I had this amazing experience. And I decided then I was going to continue. So I've written about homelessness, I've written about climate change. And then this book, when I was going around libraries and schools, I said to kids, what would you like to hear about? So one of the ones was climate change, which is why I wrote Finding Hope.
Yeah.
Which is the book that came out last year. And the other thing they talked about was divorce and separation. So I decided to write a book called About Fixing Mum and Dad. And it's about a little girl called Quinn, and her dad works abroad a lot and her parents are fighting all the time, and she's really worried that they're going to break up. And it's just about, it's very gentle, it's very, you know, sweet, very carefully done. Mm. But it's just about how sometimes the things you dread the most are in fact the best for everyone.
Big themes for small people.
But you know what?
But they can handle them.
It's for kids sort of age 13. Our kids are being bombarded with so much everywhere they go. They are well able to deal with difficult subjects. The key is to give it to them in a really sweet, heartwarming and engaging way. And that's what I do. So you create a story around an important theme, but it's engaging. And they hopefully will fall in love with the characters.
All right, I'm sure they will, as have so many readers of your previous books. That's Fixing Mum and Dad. And Sinead Moriarty, thank you for taking the time out to share your writing room with us.
Thank you.
It's been absolutely a joy to talk to you.
Likewise.
Now, we're all painfully aware of the need to build more houses in the country. It'll probably be the single biggest political issue in the upcoming general election and indeed in the budget. But this is not the first time that the state has faced this exact challenge. And upon its inception, the Irish Free State also faced a major housing crisis. So what lessons, if any, can we take from the successful housing policies of the 20th century? Well, Ruth McManus is Associate Professor of Geography in DCU and co-author of a book called Building Healthy Homes, Dublin Corporation's First Housing Schemes, 1880 to 1925, and joins me now. You're very welcome to studio, Ruth.
Thank you very much, Sinead.
So this is a hot topic all of the time since Ireland became, you know, the Republic of Ireland, and it remains so. And I know sometimes we can think it's always a today problem, but, you know, it has always been thus. And the state's involvement in housing began when we became a republic, I suppose, and we were moving from that colonialism and, you know, out of the tenements and into our own state in the early 1920s. Now, you've researched what was required at that time and the Irish government's response to it. And there were various, I think, pockets of time during the 20th century where it seemed we just went full tilt to this and did it. So talk to me about the first early inception of public housing in the country.
Yeah, so obviously there had been some housing built pre-independence, but when we come to 1922, the new Free State government realises that it really has to do something about housing. It has to be seen to do something. It has to be seen to do better than what happened before. And they talk a lot about citizenship and this idea that, well, you can't be a good citizen if you're living in terrible housing, no matter who the government is and no matter what the state is. So one of the very first things that they do in 22 is they announce £1 million grant for housing, which at the time was a real headline figure. £1 million today, of course, is a very different matter.
13 billion, maybe.
Yeah, indeed. But back then, it was intended to kickstart housing by the local authorities around the country. So particularly in urban areas where there had been pretty much no housing built for nearly a decade between the First World War and all of the turbulent times after that. So this was sort of a marker that the government was going to do something about housing. So that was for the poorest people, I suppose, the local authority housing, but also very quickly in the mid-1920s, they realised they need to get private builders back up and running again. So the legislation of the 20s not only looks at the local authority housing schemes, but it also tries to encourage private builders with various incentives as well.
So insightful and backed by money and political will. There was no doubt that it worked to a large extent to try and reframe what homes look like, and indeed maybe what homeowners look like.
Yes. So I suppose there's a couple of elements to that. In terms of what homes look like, there had been a lot of discussion during the World War One period about what makes a good quality home. And there were new housing standards introduced, and the Free State introduced its own version of those sort of model building plans, which were made available to all local authorities. And the intention with that, and particularly, I suppose, with a development like Merino, which is very well known and celebrated, is that they would provide a model and that they would raise the standards not only for public housing, but then that the private developers would be forced to raise their standards as well. So that was one part of the change.
Was there an urban-rural divide then? Because, you know, I imagine at that time we still had a huge number of people, and still do to some extent, but far more maybe who were agricultural rural dwellers. And was the thinking that we could do this at the same time, or was it to try and get the urban kind of centres sorted first?
Yeah, Ireland is sort of the reverse of most of Europe in that in the 19th century, we'd already been tackling rural housing. So this is at the time that the British government was in control. And I suppose it was much more of a political hot potato to deal with rural housing. So that had all been done pre-independence. So by the time we got to the early 20th century, rural dwellers in Ireland were among the best housed in Europe, whereas our urban slums were among the worst, not wow. just in Dublin, which we hear a lot about the tenements, but right across the country, places like Waterford as well. So that was why there was a lot of focus and attention paid to urban housing in that period of the 20s, even though the majority of the population was living in the countryside in Ireland at that time.
So did that then affect on the type of house that was built? I mean, this was long, long before we had tenements, but we didn't have apartments and tower blocks in the way that it subsequently developed as such. Was there a kind of sense that we should look at single dwelling homes and houses specifically?
Yeah, so the talk was always about the single family home, and that was a cornerstone really right throughout the period from the 20s onwards. This idea that was the most desirable and that's what we should be aspiring to, and particularly a single family home. They always call them cottages, but they're usually in urban areas, they're usually two-storey houses. But they'd have a garden front and rear. And the idea was that would enable family life to develop, that the kids would have a safe place to play, there'd be a place where you could grow your vegetables and so on. And I suppose when flats were talked about, it was always considered that they were a second best option, which was unfortunate, really. And we didn't have... If you go to London, say, there was a tradition of these mansion flats for the middle classes and, you know, very luxurious apartments. But we didn't really have anything like that in Ireland. So I suppose the association with multifamily dwelling was always with tenements and with poor quality housing. Mm. So you can kind of understand why they were anti-flat. And they built there was only one flat scheme built in Dublin in the 1920s. There was a push against it. But then when we get to the 30s and we find that we have to do something about clearing big slum areas, that's when we get those very well-known today, the Sims flats.
Yeah. So there was this kind of utopian idea of, and I suppose a lot of it was an emotional response to being a free country. This wish and desire to give people their own land, their own plot. And of course, that sense pervaded throughout the whole century, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. It is an emotional response, and there's this aspirational quality to it. And at the same time, it was a very difficult challenge. And if we look back at how these things were being discussed at the time, they were very heavily criticised. We look back now and we think, oh, that was a wonderful time and look at what was achieved. But during that period, there were an awful lot of criticisms of the policy, particularly in the 1920s, because there was a push to provide tenant purchase houses, which was partly for financial reasons. It was partly because it was the only way they could afford
to get some money back.
Yes, exactly.
selling the family silver, as it were. Yeah. Because and of course, that did continue, because when we moved further into the century, maybe for the 70s and 80s, there was a big, much bigger push, wasn't there, on home ownership and being able to own that, and local authorities saying, listen, you can buy your own home. This is aspirational stuff, rather than keeping it as public housing.
Yeah, and you can kind of understand, for individual families, it was a great opportunity for them to become homeowners, to own the house that they've been renting for years. Mm. Unfortunately, it meant that there was a reduction in the housing stock, of public housing stock. And because that wasn't... that building wasn't kept up to the same degree, you had that loss of stock. Huge numbers of houses were sold off from the late 60s onwards.
Yeah, yeah. Much to the detriment, of course, of that kind of state stock that we lost. Now, I read that you wrote there was the provision of more than 120,000 dwellings between 1923 and 1940. I mean, given our financial circumstances at the time, that is kind of an unbelievable output. And here we are in 2024, a century later, still kind of whinging about not having enough houses and not having enough abodes and not having enough will and not having enough money. I mean, what lessons do you think that we could learn today from those decisions that were made back then that did so much?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I'm often asked this, and I suppose circumstances have changed an awful lot. And particularly, it was a lot easier to build houses back then in terms of construction standards and the way that houses were built. So manual labour and just it was often
and planning kind of
where do we
or
go
lack
with
of
this?
Yeah.
Yes, I always say this, that the number one thing that differentiates that period is that despite having no money and their state was really broke at the start, they did try and they always pushed. And even though that sometimes they got the policies wrong and they were criticized for them, there was a concerted effort right through the period to actually keep pushing and keep trying to do something. And I suppose it's all very well to say these things in the present day, but when you don't see the action, that's really what's frustrating for a lot of people.
Indeed. And I suppose there was so much push on from 1920 right through to maybe nearly the 80s on this whole thing. And then it went into an abyss because we kind of adopted these free market policies and everybody can own everything and all this kind of thing. And do you feel then that even nowadays we're still playing catch up from that period of time, 50 years ago?
Very much so. Well, if you look at the Thatcherite era, I suppose, the 1980s onwards, a changing approach and a changing sense of what it meant to provide housing. So public housing became completely residualized. So in other words, it was only considered to be for the poorest of the poor, who had absolutely no other option. And it wasn't considered to be something that was for everybody, which had really been the case right up until maybe the 1960s. So this kind of very negative attitude towards the housing and lack of investment in a lot of that housing. Now, I'm thinking there is some very good housing stock that was built in the 1980s, but not enough. And the general attitude changed, and this sort of move to thinking of housing not as homes, but as commodities in more recent times has really put the cat among the pigeons.
All right. And it continues to do so. So with that in mind, of course, we will see what is ahead for us in this country. But there have been examples and plenty of them in your book of where we got it right and where we made the right decisions. Ruth McManus, Associate Professor of Geography in DCU and co-author of that book, Building Healthy Homes, Dublin Corporation's First Housing Schemes. Thank you for joining us on The Home Show.
Thank you very much, Sinead.
Now, in July, Museum of the Home in London opened a new interactive exhibit called Rooms Through Time, featuring generations of rooms from migrant homes in the city. And one of those is from an Irish couple living in London in 1956. So that was peak emigration time from Ireland to London. So what's in the room and what else can people expect to see from a visit to Museum of the Home? Well, Danielle Patton is Director of Creative Programmes and Collections and joins me now. Danielle, you're very welcome along to the Home Show. Talk to me a little bit about the museum itself, because it has been around for quite some time.
Yeah, so the Museum of the Home has been around for just over 100 years. And at the museum, which is based in London, we look at the past, present and future of home life. So we look at how home has evolved over the past 400 years. And we do this through our galleries. So some are taking a thematic look at home, so looking at things like entertainment, or you can come and play on video games and do kind of lots of fun things and explore the fun ways people have lived at home in the past. But then, as you mentioned, we also have our Rooms Through Time galleries. And this is a real opportunity for visitors to kind of see how homes have changed over the past 400 years. So we look at design and architecture, but also the stories of the people who've made home and kind of lived in these spaces in the past too. We have beautiful gardens too, to look at outside spaces as well as the interiors. And we're set in really charming 18th century buildings. So it's a bit of an oasis in the middle of the City of London.
Indeed. Now, this exhibit, which is the Rooms Through Time, focuses on, I suppose, the immigrant community, because London of the 50s and indeed, the decades following it was a melting pot of both colonies, former colonies, and people who saw London as, you know, their opportunity, their streets paved with gold. But of course, they would have all brought parts from home to them. So tell us a little bit about the types of immigrant homes that you have featured there.
Yes, exactly as you say. In the 1950s, kind of after the Second World War, there were so many opportunities in London. So the kind of the city was being rebuilt after the bombings, but also huge institutions like the NHS had been formed. So there was a huge workforce that was needed to make that work. So the government did a big call out, kind of a big global call out for people to come and kind of take part in this rebuilding and kind of take up some of these opportunities. So London was seen in lots of ways as this kind of like welcoming space, a space of opportunities. There was still lots of kind of discrimination for people that kind of came to make home in the city. But over, we look at the kind of period from the 1870s into the future. So really track some of these big migration trends that kind of happened during that period. So we look at, as you say, kind of from the colonies, so people travelling from places like India, also looking at people from Eastern Europe, so kind of like Jewish communities coming to London. And we look at the different types of homes that these families or kind of couples, single people, often kind of made up their homes within. So we look at kind of modern tower blocks that people were kind of repurposing and making their communities in, also tenement flats. And the Irish couple in the 1950s, they're making up their home in a new build terraced house. So kind of rebuilt after the bombings, and they're sharing a room within a kind of a rented house. So kind of looking at the different ways that people are setting up homes throughout the period.
So the Irish couple you've chosen are called Kathleen and Jack. She's a nurse, he's going over to work in construction. And of course the 1950s was a pretty dire time in Ireland, so lots and lots and lots of people left to seek a better life for themselves and their families. So in terms of what the Irish brought to London, I mean, we know, in terms of, as you said, the newly forged NHS of that time, that the city was being rebuilt after the war. So lots and lots of, for a nurse and a construction worker to get involved in. But how they lived was also important. So describe the Irish room for me, please, Danielle.
Yes, and you say that obviously it was kind of looking for opportunities in London, but also London itself was in quite a kind of state of disrepair. And London still had, and the UK still had rationing in the 1950s. So actually lots of Irish people that moved over to the UK, they were quite surprised at the poor quality of food that they were finding and the kind of the diet of the English. They were quite surprised at how poor it was. So there was a bit of a mix of kind of things were kind of better and worse. But the room, as I say, it's their whole home really would have been a room that they were renting within a wider home. a wider house. So they have quite kind of modern 1950s furniture that they would have bought. And at the time, you could pick up kind of these pieces relatively kind of cheaply. So you could really make this space your own without spending kind of huge amounts of money. So there's that kind of modernist kind of style that comes into the space. But then also these real kind of strong symbols of Irish culture too. So they're both Catholic, so they have lots of kind of Catholic imagery and objects within the rooms, but also music and kind of lots of the Irish culture comes through. So there's a kind of a fiddle within the room, so Irish music is really strong. They're going off to a dance hall, so that's kind of a real part of their home life and wider community. Also Irish literature, so they're bringing these kind of aspects of their life from Ireland to London, and they're not just kind of sharing that within their home, they're also feeding into this wider Irish community within London and other kind of city centres across the UK. And there'll be kind of places like the London Irish Centre, who we worked with to curate the room. They were set up in the 1950s to kind of provide this hub for people migrating over from Ireland. So they're kind of really changing the face of the wider city and kind of changing the music scene across London too.
Mm. Indeed. And when you were curating the exhibit, where did you source the stuff? Is it all original items of furniture and clothing and shoes, or is it kind of fabricated to create this look?
Yes, it's a bit of a mix of both. So the room itself is fabricated, and it's kind of based on different testimony and kind of archival material, photographs from the period and from lots of photographs that people have donated. But some of the objects within the rooms are personal objects that people have either donated to the museum or are on loan because they're just too precious to kind of fully give away. So we're kind of looking after them for a little while for people. And we also collected the story. So it might be that people told us these wonderful stories about a wardrobe they had, and they would kind of like fill up, they would buy dresses and kind of save up to buy these dresses. And this wardrobe would have been kind of a really special part of their life. We don't have that exact wardrobe, but we've kind of bought a similar type. And we'll kind of eventually, hopefully, when people come to visit, they might say, oh, actually, I have a similar one of those and I have the story to go with it.
I imagine that, and I'm looking at the pictures of the room now, and I know there are homes in Ireland that have still have, and actually they're now sought after again, that kind of mid-century,
yes,
now retro furniture of this veneer wood and curved lines and very, very sought after these days. So it'll be interesting for people to go along. Now, just for visitors from Ireland who are heading to London for the rest of the year, tell us where the museum is based and how long the exhibit will be running.
So the museum is in Hoxton in East London, and we are just opposite a tube, so you kind of can't miss us, and from Hoxton Underground Station. And the exhibition is permanent. So although we'll change some aspects, like I said, we hope to collect more stories and collect more objects and bring out different themes. But we hope that this will be a real centre for people kind of from Ireland visiting London to come and see and to kind of share their stories and reflect on their experiences and the experiences of their families.
Indeed. And of course, the very, very many Irish people or people of Irish origin still living in London and bringing up their families there who might well remember this time. And I know some of them do listen to the Home Show. Danielle Patton, Director of Creative Programmes and Collections at the Museum of the Home in London. Thank you for joining us on the Home Show today.
Well, thank you for speaking to me. It's been wonderful.
Now, the powder room, the guest WC, it may be the smallest room in the house, but it's a big opportunity to wow your friends and family when they visit. And with some imagination, a little creativity, you can transform the downstairs loo into a stunning space that'll have everybody talking. So who better to have ideas than our own Denise O'Connor of Optimised Design? You love this kind of space, don't you? You're
writing about it recently. Yeah,
and
no, it is like you say, it is such an opportunity. And it's, you know, even for people who aren't that brave, it's an opportunity to do something a little bit out there.
Isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, you're not you're going to be using this all, you're not going to have your own ablutions in there in the morning. You're not going to have a shower in there. You're not going to be using it all the time. And if you've kind of elephant's breath everywhere else in the house and the neutral fabrics, you know, I think it can be quite nice to go in and have people going, whoa, what have you done in here?
Definitely. And the other thing, it's a small space, so you can afford to splash out a little bit because you're not having to buy rolls and rolls of wallpaper, for example. So
yeah,
you don't have to break the bank, but you can do something really special.
Yeah, I was saying at the top of the show, I did my own last summer. I take a project on each year.
Fabulous.
And I went into this kind of, it started out as something completely different. And it was advice in a paint shop where they said, look, would you think of painting the sloping ceiling or cocooning it in a dark colour?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, no. I was thinking white because it's tiny. And I ended up with this kind of going full kind of Middle Eastern.
Wonderful.
It's like walking into a bazaar in Marrakesh. I probably went completely over the top, but I had the best fun with it.
This is it. And look, and when you walk in, it'll give you a boost, make you smile. And if you really don't like it in a year's time,
yeah,
it's not the end of the world.
Just
to change
swap it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So let's start then with colour, since we're looking at that. Because, you know, it is this instinctive thing. It's the smallest space.
Yeah.
Possibly windowless.
Yes.
And the last thing you think you want is to make it dark or have anything other than the brightest white.
Yeah, and it is, you're absolutely right. It's almost counterintuitive. So with small spaces, we tend to think, go bright. But it can feel really bland, you know, really flat. So with a small space, especially if there's no windows, go dark. Just embrace that fact because you're going to have the lights on when you're in there. Be lots of natural lighting. You can do something really special with lighting. So it's really nice to go for a super dark colour and, like you did, cocoon the space, like go on the ceiling, go on the skirting boards, the back of the door, like really embrace
that
colour. Yeah,
I didn't. I stopped short at the door and the skirt because I was just like, ooh, I didn't want it to feel like a cave, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe I'll take another swing at that.
Yeah, I think so. I think you'd be pleasantly surprised. It really sort of, it almost expands the space because when you have the contrast of the white woodwork with the darker colour, you're breaking it up.
Oh,
but when you paint everything, it sort of just expands it out and actually makes the space feel a little bit more roomy inside.
Interesting. So it's like an optical illusion.
Yes.
So when you say go dark, talk to me about the colours you're considering.
So the kinds of colours, like I'm not talking about primary colours or anything that's sort of going to give you a headache when you walk in there. So lovely.
Not purpy pink.
No. Right. Or yeah, pure red or cobalt blue. But even things like navies, you know, what I would term dark neutral. So those lovely greens, all those jewel tones, burgundies, those sort of rich shades feel really luxurious and cocooning when you go into them. So those are always a really good bet and always super smart. And then they look amazing with some of the incredible brassware that's out there now at the moment, like the brass or the antique bronze. All really starts to come to life with those sort of dark backdrops.
Indeed. And can you punt out a little bit then on kind of the extra special paint? And we all know the ones we're talking about. Because it's a small space,
yeah.
Would you, I mean, there's this kind of thing about matte and soft sheen and all
yes.
that, but really, doesn't it come down to the pigment,
yes.
the amount of pigment? Are you going for those really rich, powdery tones nearly,
yeah.
or do you prefer a sheeny kind of finish?
No, I think, and you know, paint has come on now so much, so you can get those. It used to be that the darker shades were very hard to get a durable finish in, and honestly, they will show up marks more, like a navy wall is going to show up marks. It just will, it'll scuff easier. But a lot of the paints are now super durable in those colourways. So again, best to speak to the people in the paint shop if you're worried about wear and tear. But again, it's such a small room. It's not that heavily trafficked, I would hope. So you shouldn't be so concerned about lots of scuffs and things happening in rooms like that. Mm. But I would always go for a matte finish on your walls and then something like an eggshell finish on the woodwork. So your skirtings, the back of the door, architraves in a nice eggshell. But yeah, to go with a soft sheen on the walls, it can just look a little old fashioned.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you're calling that colour drenching. That was a term
yes.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
That's what it's called.
Colour drenching.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned there accessories.
Yeah.
And I am a huge fan of the brass, the brushed brass
yes.
look.
Yeah.
That kind of Art Deco sense of that kind of pale gold and that. I love it.
Yeah.
And there's lots of it about.
Yeah, it's lovely. Like I remember the one of our first home when I lived away, everything in the place was brass, but it was that old-fashioned brass. So I have to admit to being really allergic to it for a long time. So it's taken me a while to come around again. But I think now what's really lovely about the brass, there is that brushed finish, that sort of more matte satin finish. And the fittings are more contemporary. So before, it used to be that it was only the more old-fashioned or traditional style came in a brass finish. But now you get these beautiful fittings and all of the accessories are available to complement it. Mm. So, you know, your towel rail, your toilet roll holder, everything can come in the same finish, which is lovely.
And I know you were speaking there of being allergic to things. There are some people who are allergic to the matchy-matchy.
Yes.
Finish.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Is it okay in a downstairs loo? Does it tie it together if your little towel rail and your loo roll holder and your soap rack are all the same?
I think it does. I think there has to be some kind of common language. So, you know, say, for example, somebody who loves collecting vintage pieces, as long as they're all of a similar era, or like you were mentioning, the Art Deco, as long as there's a sort of similar language to all the pieces, it will work. It's where you just sort of mishmash like a chrome tap with a brass toilet roll holder, and you know, it's going to look a bit chaotic.
Okay, so if you're redoing it, take the time out to get everything from the same era.
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
exactly.
Okay. Now, in terms of, and I just paint it because that's all I can do. That's kind of the bulk of my abilities.
Yeah.
But I know that you like, and I know other designers like a wallpaper in a bathroom. Now, I kind of in my head, there's big alarm bells going off because I'm thinking water and wallpaper and the two should never mix. But things have changed.
Yeah. And I think wallpaper in a downstairs WC, like it's not like in a bathroom where you're going to have lots of steam from showers or baths or things like that. So the wallpaper, it's not going to get much abuse, minimal splashing, I would think, and easy to wipe it away. There are also wallpapers that are suitable for bathrooms, so you can check that, different finishes, but it should be perfectly fine in a bathroom.
And you're probably not going to have like the steam you'd get out of a shower or anything like that because you don't have it. Okay. I love taking inspiration from fabulous hotels and restaurants that have gone all out on bathrooms and you can take elements from it. And we all know there's great ones out there. But a lot of them go full maximalist, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's not about that kind of cool, colour-drenching, minimalist thing. Mm. There's big flowers on the walls and gold seats and all that kind of thing. Can you, you know, is if you get it right, can that work?
I think it's definitely a space for you to explore your preferences and to try and bring your personality out. So if that's your personality, you're big and bold and love that sort of flamboyant style, go for it. You know, it's such a small space, you can have a little bit of fun. But personally, I prefer something a little bit more pared back, maybe a little more Scandinavian in tone. So for me, it would be a bit too much. But definitely, I've seen where it has been really, really successful. But I think if you're going to go for it, go for it. Don't sort of halfway do it. Yeah. That's where it all starts to look a bit wrong.
Now, one of the things that we have to get right in the downstairs loo, if there is no natural light and no window, because very often it's an internal space, is the lighting.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's huge options out there. So what do you recommend?
I think a really good idea, if you can do it, is to have two different light sources. So that would mean having a switch outside that has two separate switches. So maybe you've got a wall light by your mirror or a couple of wall lights, and then you'd have overhead lighting in the ceiling for when you're cleaning or whatever. So really, you're only ever going to need some sort of ambient lighting in that space, because it'll be for guests, for you occasionally to use. So it's not a room where you need full on super bright lights.
You're not putting on all your makeup or...
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So there are great bulbs out there, even like those naked bulbs that are common amber and kind of low pink and orange lights. And they can be really effective.
Yeah, they're fabulous. And there's amazing fittings now as well where you can change the colour temperature of the bulb. So you can have it sort of a much brighter, whiter light during the day, if let's say you did need to put your makeup on or whatever. But in the evening, you can change the tone and make it much, much warmer. So loads of options that aren't that expensive. Mm.
Now, one of the things, of course, we reserve for the guest loo are the prop, you know, the really posh soaps and hand cream. Because there's this feeling like you want your guests to think, like, oh, we live like this all the time. You know? We only ever use Farrow and Ball on the walls and, you know, Jo Malone scented whatever. So is that kind of the right thing to do? Is that the space for it?
I think it's a lovely idea. Again, it brings that hotel feel, that sort of like you're almost pampering your guests and yourself a little bit too. So why not? You know, like a really nice hand soap, really nice little hand cream, maybe a nice scented candle for when people come over.
Yeah.
Just nice little touches, and even a little vase with some flowers or something if you're having guests over. Just those little touches make it feel a little bit more special,
right,
which is lovely.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, that's a project for everybody to get on with. So you're going for that, yeah, hotel spa kind of finish in it some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, and having it absolutely lovely. So it's really about mood. And where do you stand on wall art, Denise?
I love art. I love adding any kind of impact, any kind of statement. Again, it's about showcasing your personality. So anything that's going to make people go, oh, yeah, that's so Sinead, or, you know, just make people stop and think for a little bit. So like we've had clients who've framed up all sorts of things that are very personal to them. And the downstairs WC is the perfect place to put them.
And you've time to sit around and look at the walls
and
check all the children's achievements and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Very, very good. Now, I know that you have celebrity clients from time to time, and you're probably not going to tell me who they are, but I'm going to ask you anyway. And the downstairs loo is very often seen as the place where, you know, you kind of tongue in cheek put your Oscar or your BAFTA or your award for whatever.
Yeah.
Do you find that becomes then a talking point for that space?
I'm not sure. I think we have seen people put some interesting things, in these tiny little spaces. So again, it comes down to that sort of creating the element of surprise for people going in there. They're going to see something they weren't expecting. And I think we can all achieve that to some extent, even if we don't have an Oscar to put in there. It's possible to do that.
Yeah, you can kind of pretend you're modest, but actually look at me.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Brilliant. All right. Well, great suggestions as ever. And I know on your Instagram site, Optimized Design, there's loads and loads of ideas there and people can go and have a look. Actually, I know one of the posts you did, because you were talking about that Scandi look, you did this lovely wall paneling in a loo, and I thought, gosh, I thought the decals were hard enough, but actually it was very effective.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. Like, we've used actual flooring on walls, and that's really, really effective. It sort of creates that sort of almost Scandi sauna feel, but in a really warm, cozy way. And even you can do the ceiling and stuff. And when you use the wide plank flooring, it looks really, really contemporary and super
like
luxurious.
Shiplap or?
No, just so exactly the way you would lay it on your floor, and then you just put it on the walls as well.
Right.
So it can look really, really well, amazing in a really small space.
And part of that kind of cocooning thing you were talking about. All right. Well, Denise O'Connor of Optimized Design, thanks a million for doing that. And if you are doing up the smallest room in the house, why not send us a picture? Let us have a look at the before and after. We'd love to see it. That's all we have time for this week. We've covered a lot, I hope, and I hope you've enjoyed the range of guests we've on and also the topics that we've covered. If there's anything you'd like to suggest that we look at on the home show, and of course any of your favourite authors for our Writer's Room series, well, of course, get in touch with us, and you can do that during the week on email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. My thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey. Researcher was Rory Galvin, and Stephen McLoon was on sound. Have a fantastic weekend.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
Saturday morning at 8 on Newstalk.